Okay, so let's just go over a little bit of what we've been looking at this weekend. I guess what we've been very, very contemplating is this idea of everything being interconnected, and then this idea of working with the kind of energies of weaving and unweaving, or more accurately, probably unweaving and then weaving. So there's something about this sense of if we are in an interconnected universe, and therefore we can't separate ourselves from things, how can we operate effectively then? That's the kind of... So the process, I suppose, we've been contemplating is this whole idea of bringing together the different sides of ourselves, if you like, the creative and intuitive, together with the kind of the rational and the sort of linear, so as to achieve a kind of measure of integration and sovereignty that then enables us to sort of to work with whatever we find, whether it's stuff inside ourselves or stuff in our immediate environment or stuff in the larger world. And the and I suppose the other thing that we've been addressing in that, well, okay, what that sounds relatively straightforward, what gets in the way of that, what stops that process from being in a relatively straightforward process? And I suppose today in particular we've been looking at this kind of idea of this of the amalgamation of thought and image and feeling that in a way creates a sort of a shape, really, that is not under our conscious control, and that entraps this energy that I'm calling will. And so this process that we've been looking at today in particular, of really, in a sense, of really looking at what helps to transform the will, and starting to look in a way at this alchemical process, which is where we create an alchemical kind of container, and then within that container pay attention to this living mass of thought and feeling and image that has become solidified. And that, in frankly, has its own life. I mean, that you know, so the place where we find ourselves spontaneously liking or disliking people, sometimes on no evidence, or sometimes we're right, but sometimes it's because somebody reminds us of somebody, because there's a sort of they've got a look of a somebody, if you like, these patterns or substrate within us is actually very active. It's a creative, renewed process that's at work all the time. Now, as we discover that when we pay attention to this consciously, bringing in the help of the angels or the spirits or whatever word we give to that, and we start then to come into a process where we start to free up those locked energies. But that, of course, creates instability. The whole point of the form that we have, if you like, the shape that we have, is we've learned to be in it. So my image of myself is embedded in my image of the universe. So if I start to change something about my image of the universe and something about the image of myself through working like this, I start to unravel everything. Because the stability, it's a bit like this thing where we looked at this idea of the moon and the earth being in a stable dynamic. This is a kind of a similar thing. This inner structure that we have inside ourselves It is a balanced structure. It's a structure in movement, and it's a complex layered structure, but it is a balanced system. So as you start to tinker with any part of it, you start to create imbalance. And that's why this whole image of sovereignty, of creating stability, of holding, is really kind of important. Because without that, we start to lose the containment of the alchemical vessel. And the whole point of transformation really is that we have established sovereignty, which is that sense of presence, rootedness, and center and alignment. And then we have this sense of boundary, this sense of edge, that gives us that feeling of stability. Now, if you have that sense of sovereignty and sense of stability, then as you bring your energy, intention, and awareness in towards these places and start to shift them, if they become too unstable, you can shift back towards a sense of sovereignty, towards a sense of containment, give the movement space. And you know, so sometimes you know the processes need more heat. Sometimes they need less heat. Sometimes you really need to lean into something and work on it and focus on it, and that produces good results. Sometimes, and if the container's starting to wobble, well, you don't want the container to blow up and fragment, because then everything mixes up everything else and you can do nothing. So if the container starts to wobble, you lean away from it, you create space, you enable a sense of stability to hold the process. Maybe you even stop the process for a while and let the process go on unconsciously for a bit. So it's a real kind of art of determining useful limits. Now, the alchemical processes that happen, where, you know, if you read alchemical literature, is notoriously hellish to read, because it's partly written deliberately to confuse people. Because they had a big thing about this is a secret thing you can't show people. So there's if you read different texts, they give up something, you've got 24 processes, 12 processes, 8 processes. But generally speaking, there are 7 basic processes that I think are useful when we look at this process of change. And the central one is this idea called nigredo, or dying. It's also sometimes called mortifactio. It's about death. It's about the unweaving, the beginning of things starting to fall apart. Because it's that dying process, that the dissolution of the stability, that opens the space for the new energy to arise. So when we're looking really at the bringing in getting present in ourselves, bringing in the angels, creating the sphere, aligning with these energies from above and below, and creating this sense of fusion in the center. That place of fusion, what happens in that place of balanced fusion? So if that works, you create this secure feeling sphere. You have this, which has this sense of movement, and in the center, you've got this point of stability that whose energy it is to bring opposites together and transform them. So as you center yourself in that place, and as that comes into relationship with your kind of inner material, this place of unweaving or breaking down or nigredo, blackening, starts to happen. And this sets off a reaction which runs through your whole system. And then, depending on the needs or the particular needs of the process, and you don't even really have to know these names, because the process is just organic and follows itself. And it happens in different combinations depending on the needs. So one of the things that can happen is you may create a greater sense of separation between parts of the inner material. Or some other parts may join together. Who have been separate in the process. The process may need to be intense or very fiery. It may need to be very gentle and very watery and dissolving. It may need to be a process of expansion, of sublimation, where you can open out and see an overview. It may need to be very dense and embodied and coagulated and focused. Now, that just happens as long as you create the container, bring your attention to it, and hold this intention to bring awareness into these places that need to change. the key thing, and what you're doing there is cooperating with the freeing of the will. So if we think of this, the will, your will, or which is this vector directionality of our intention coming out of the mysterious aspect of our nature, if we consider that this has somehow got locked into stereotypic patterns, locked in images of thought and feeling, basically based on history. So what, as we can learn to tolerate that kind of bringing attention into that, bringing that kind of energy, or having the help of the angels to first of all empty the sphere, but then to bring together this new energy, and as we just learn to relax into that and to let it work us, what we start to find happening is, yes, there is instability which needs holding, but there's also a greater sense of freedom, a sense of alignment, a sense of being able to move more fluidly and being less at the mercy of our internal conditions. Now the thing about that is it is an ongoing process. So whatever you do, you know, it requires that work little by little. You know, this is a very if you think of this form, it's really tangled, it's very dense. You may want to cut straight through it, but actually, if you did cut straight through it, it would immediately reattach itself in a new form. Actually, the process is—it's very like that process of the castle of the wall in the Prithayanovan, where you come up against something and it has to be slowly digested. So it's a sort of, you know, or if you like, another way of taking it, you could see this as a great knot that gradually you learn to unpick. And of course, there's the frustration and the wish to cut it apart. But generally speaking, what works is to really disentangle it and in a way, it's allowing space into it, so it becomes looser. And a very tight knot, of course, is almost impossible to undo. And a knot that's loose is really easy. So that process of being present, bringing space into it, allowing ourselves to kind of, in a way, to feel the in-betweenness of the different patterns, really kind of helps just to sort of loosen. But in that process, we then have to tolerate the fear that arises, because as things loosen, they feel less stable, less substantial, we get scared. So part of the work is learning to sort of ride that tide of fear that arises, and that's where it sort of has to be little by little, otherwise it becomes too overwhelming. Now the image of this book Eshmezarev uses for this process is this process of immersion in the River Jordan. You know, it's the baptism image. And the thing about immersion is you have to let yourself sink down and come up. So there's a movement between opposites. River Jordan itself also represents that kind of flow or river that unites the north and the south and the east and the west. Still a big, I mean, even in political terms, you know, the River Jordan is a very, you know, powerful political river, because you've got the east bank of the Jordan, which is Israel, you've got the west bank, which is Palestine, and so that image of the River Jordan, or even in current cultural terms, is polarizing a lot of opposites. North of Israel, you find Iran, who hates Israel, and so that's north, south, east, west. You've got this image of splitting that's around that kind of river, and in a sense, the work that we're doing is really countercultural, because it is about not splitting. It is about bringing opposites together in this container, in the still container, and then the actual work is just to be present with it. But that being present with it, having sought the help of the angel, sought the help of the mysterious, the bigger, being present isn't just our presence, it's the presence of the angels, it's the presence of the deeper, that then starts this alchemical process of dissolution and reconstitution. Yeah, go, go, no, go ahead, go, yeah, ask.
So I think you've got pre-birth stuff. You can change a little tiny pattern.
Yeah.
And it gives you a freedom to do something different.
Yeah.
But you still have the old way, should you wish to have it.
Yeah.
Does that apply here?
Yeah, it does apply here, because the choice, you have it as a choice.
It becomes a choice rather than a compulsion.
It becomes a choice rather than a compulsion, right? That's the difference, right? Until it's somehow digested and worked with, it's actually not a choice. This is what happens. It's a compulsion. So it doesn't mean that you can't move back into those places if it feels appropriate and wise and you want to. So the choice is not taken away, but the compulsion is. So that's the big difference in it somehow.
The child here does represent
that kind of newness, that innocence, that in a way that the sorcerer's kind of, because actually the interesting thing about the sorcerer is killing the child isn't going to work, because there's a bloody great dragon underneath that's shaking the tower down. But the sorcerers are operating out of history and memory, and so in a way they do represent those kind of patterns from the past, whereas the image of the child, who is just simple and somehow looks and sees, oh, I know, there's dragons down there stirring everything up.
Is the child the White Hart?
Is the child the White Hart?
He's a truce sorcerer, isn't he?
Yeah, well, in a way, I suppose he is. He's mediating, and he is the mediator. So he is able to see. And I suppose he does then act as White Hart from that point of view, because then he is able to show and lead the way. Because actually, he doesn't do it, but he shows Vortigern what he needs to do. He's got to drain the pool, and has to let the dragons out, and then the dragons have to be found and put to sleep so they don't disturb the foundations. So I suppose in that sense he does act as the White Hart. He is that intuitive kind of energy. Now the other thing, so that in a way this is the sort of deeply internal thing that we've been looking at, but of course when we look at the sort of interconnected universe, is the idea that the inside and the outside are interconnected, and therefore that this sort of subtle activism thing we've touched into a little bit, which we're going to come back to, but is in there somewhere. The idea that not only are we is our inner life of course affected by the things that come in from the outside, but the work that we do here also affects the outside. So the studies I talked about yesterday, which are kind of interesting, particularly the Jerusalem study, I think, you know, is challenging to the, because one of the things that in cultural conditioning, it's easy to believe the outside affects the inside, right? I mean, that's a normal kind of idea. The idea that inner work without outer causal activity can affect the outside world is a much more challenging idea. And just as we finish this weekend, what I'm going to do is sort of, I don't want to do any more deep work, because I think you've done enough. It's been an intense weekend, and we don't need. But what I want to do, I'm just going to read you some stuff about the work that Dion Fortune did at the beginning of the Second World War, because this was another form of a very clear form of subtle activism. And because it was really about, writing letters to people, getting themselves to sit and meditate. Basically what they did was to sit and meditate together regularly in relationship to the inner life of the collective, not just their own inner life, but they were specifically addressing the collective life of Britain and the world during the war years. So I'm just going to read you a little bit of some of this. Let's just check before I do that, because we'll be shifting into this. Is there anything else that needs tidying up before out of this weekend, before I go on to do that? Any questions or thoughts that people want to share before I just go into this wrapping up bit?
something about the interconnected universe, which I think is just banging it up for myself. Because partly it just feels like this is what you've been doing this weekend is almost like bringing the whole of the first Darwin training together and where we are now.
Yeah.
It's like interconnecting the alchemy with the old fortune with angels.
Yeah.
There just seems to be so, like cross-pollinating weekends.
Well, it's the intention of the weekend in a way to sort of really kind of gather as much, gather as much of the material, as much of the stuff we've been looking at together, that is into some kind of shape. I mean, the key thing, of course, is just to, is just to listen to that and feel your own reaction to that. And we're going to go further with this in subsequent weekends, really. But it's because one of the things I want to look at in particular is this connection between the inside and the outside, and contemplation and activism, and how do those two things come together, and how can they come together in a way that is genuinely meaningful as opposed to fanciful. I mean, it's easy to sit and imagine that I'm affecting the world. But it's also easy to be really, really active and think I'm affecting the world and not affect the world as well. So there's a sort of, there's different layers of this thing about, if I bring together contemplation and action, then the action that arises out of contemplation, I think, can be more effective. But also the activity of contemplation can be effective. You know, so there's something where we're taking these two words, contemplation and activism, together and playing with them a bit and seeing that there's the contemplation as activism in itself, and seeing activism as contemplation in as contemplative activity. So it's, I'm not saying this very well, but it's about playing back and forth with these ideas.
There's a slogan called ritual and action, action and ritual.
Yeah.
Particularly amongst the anti-fracking groups. They try and bring that together in that frame.
Yeah, that's the same kind of territory, same sort of thing I'm talking about, I think, really. It's exactly that. So it's... And that activism, or if you like, is of course about anything. It's not just political. With activism, we immediately think political, but activism is if you like, is the our activity in the world. It's the activity between two people in a family. It's in a small community, in a large community, in relationship to the world. So it's that whole kind of spectrum, in a sense. So we're going to head more into that kind of territory. So I'm going to just end today by just reading you some excerpts of Sabdian Fortune and just explaining a little bit about what she was doing during these kind of war years. And because it's kind of unusual, and we've actually got her letters that were written at the time. So it's a record, if you like, of a form of a contemplative activity. That she certainly believed, and the people around her believed, was effective in some way. So I'll just tell you, first of all, just read you the beginning bit of it, so you can know what they actually did. So it started really at the beginning of October 1939, which is 1 month after the outbreak of war. And so she sent out a letter saying meditation instructions. And I'll just read you the meditation instructions. So it is, and this is something they did every Sunday morning, basically. The members of the Fraternity of the Inner Light have been carefully trained in the theory and practice of meditation. Every Sunday morning from 12:15 to 12:30, certain members will hold a meditation circle in the sanctuary at 3 Queensborough Terrace, that's where they had their headquarters. Other members scattered all over the country will also sit in meditation at the same time. Thus a nucleus of trained minds will be formed. All who'd care to join in this work are invited to participate. They should proceed as follows. The weekly letters will be sent every Wednesday in order to ensure the punctual arrival in time for the following Sunday. You see, there's a better postal system in those days than we have, don't you? On that day, but not before, study the contents of the letter in preparation for the United Meditation at 12:15. It's inadvisable to study the papers sooner than this, lest the concentration on the previous week's work be disturbed. Success can only be achieved by single-pointed concentration. The meditation work consists of certain well-defined stages, each of which must be performed before passing on to the next. These stages are the steps of a stair, on which the mind rises to a higher level of consciousness, performs certain work there, and then returns to normal. Stage 1. Having studied the letter, take your seat, if possible, in a quiet, dimly lit room, secure from disturbance, face towards London. Sit in such an attitude that your feet are together and your hands clasped, thus making a closed circuit of yourself. Your hands should rest on the weekly letter lying on your lap, for these letters will be consecrated before they're sent out, in order that they may form a link. So that's interesting. So she's talking about a tangible, obviously people are sent tangible letters, and and as these letters are produced, she's making a sort of energetic sort of link, really, between herself and whoever receives the letter. And the idea being there that as you sit in a stable, quiet way, but you hold the letter, and so you have an object there that represents a connection between yourself and the unfortunate and her London group. Breathe as slowly as you can without strain, making a slight pause at the beginning of ending of each breath. Thus breathe in, pause, breathe out, pause. The attitude should be poised, free from all strain, either sitting or lying. If sitting, have some support for the back. The position should be symmetrical, so that both sides of the body are the same. It should be taken up a few minutes before the meditation is due to start, so that you have time to settle down into a posture of balanced relaxation and stabilize your breathing. Once the meditation has begun, think no more about your breathing. So that's the first stage. Stage 2. Contemplate your meditation by thinking about the subject allotted for the work of the week. Try and realize its spiritual implications, but do not attempt to consider its practical ones, for this will distract you and cause mind wandering. Realize that ethical principles are involved. If you have any knowledge of the Kabbalistic method, place your meditation on the tree. Stage 3. Having thoroughly filled your mind with the ideas set for the meditation work, picture in your imagination a symbolic image, figure, or scene that shall symbolize it. Keep this before your mind's eye. Slow down your thought processes till you begin to feel rather than reason. Try, as it were, to listen mentally. Don't try and hold this mental stillness for more than a few minutes, even if you feel you're getting results, because it's a very potent method of mind working, and not good to do it for long at a time. However fascinating you may find it, discipline yourself to pass on firmly to the next stage, for it is here that the real work is done. So stage 4. Mentally dedicate yourself in the name of the all good to the service of the one life without distinction of friend and foe. Let the good that you're attempting to invoke come through for all, relying upon the cosmic law to adapt it to their needs or their healing. Stage 5. Think of yourself as part of the group soul of your race, your life a part of its life, and its life the basis of yours. Then, invoking the name of God, open your mind as a channel for the work of the Masters of Wisdom. Stage 6. Meditate again on the subject set for the work of the week. Stage 7. At the conclusion, say aloud, "It is finished." Imagine a pair of black velvet curtains being drawn across the scene you have built up in your imagination, as if it were on a stage. Let the curtains approach from either side till they meet in the middle, thus blotting out the scene. Rise from your seat and stamp your foot firmly on the ground to reaffirm your return to normal consciousness. So this is basically the kind of method that she was using. So you start off by paying attention to the body, paying attention to your breathing. You then have this letter that has a set of ideas and instructions, which we'll go on to in a moment. And so you're physically making a link with that by holding it. There's an important idea there where she gets you then to start thinking, to start tuning into that, to the idea. And then she importantly says, don't be distracted by the practical energies of this. Be very kind of aware that you're looking at spiritual principles and stay with that idea. Then what she invites you to do is to take that idea into a more felt place and to allow an image to arise. So that's when she's looking at the sort of work that we're looking at, really, where you allow the image to kind of embody. You do it very briefly at this point. You're not doing it very, very fully, because you're sort of tuning in to the territory, coming into the territory. And then what she does is you lean back then into the deeper field. So this idea, what she's calling the all good, or the spirit, or the one life without distinction, or friend or foe. So you're then sort of opening yourself to this, if you like, the deepest field of the universe. But then you discover, you align yourself as part of the collective territory that you're in, which she's calling the group soul of your race. So then you're sort of, if you like, having gone into the universal, you're then locating yourself within the collective field that you find yourself in. In this case, she's looking at, you know, she's looking at the war. She's looking at Britain as a kind of an entity at war. So you're attuning to that. But then, having your life, your life is a part of its life. Its life is the basis of yours. So you're looking at that interconnectedness between the collective and your individual life. So you're starting to create that together. Then, invoking the name of God, you open your mind as a channel for the work of the Masters of Wisdom. Now, Masters of Wisdom, again, is an old theosophical term that she was using at that time. It kind of represents the spiritual beings. And so you have the sense of the divine life underneath everything. And then you're particularly attuning to spiritual beings who have a kind of an interest. And it's a bit like our image of the angels, spiritual beings who have an interest in helping or bringing the divine life into expression. And having done, make that connection, then you return to the subject of the week. So having kind of, if you like, tuned yourself in, created an image, you then come back to that image with that greater sense of alignment, and then open yourself to then what emerges. When you finish the meditation, you very distinctly close it off and bring yourself back down into kind of solidity. So that's the basic kind of meditation that happens. And if you're interested, the book is called The Magical Battle of Britain. What's interesting about it in terms of, is that the Basil Wilby, Gareth Knight, who compiled this, has done a really nice job of compiling the letters. And he's alongside the letters, he gives us a timeline for what's actually happening in the war at this time. So this is kind of, basically this begins in October 1939, and we discover that today Adolf Hitler formally incorporates the Polish border areas into the German Reich. And if you remember, it is the invasion of Poland that triggered the declaration of war. So what we discover really is that she, in the first letter, she talks about what she means by the concepts of the group mind and the group soul. She says, the fraternity of the inner light has for one of its rules the avoidance of all participation in politics, national and international. And these letters sent to our friends and members whom the call of war has scattered are no departure from that rule. For there are certain basic principles that transcend all partisanship. These are the prerogative of no party nor any nation, but are shared by all things living because they are the laws of evolving life. In the light of these spiritual principles, we can guide our lives with steadfast uncertainty through all crises and may know a sense of inner peace and security that cannot be shaken by any circumstances, not even death itself. And more than that, we can learn how best to bring such gifts as we have to give to the common weal. For though there is no lack of goodwill and sacrifice, efficiency is not so common. Whatever we may be doing, active service, civil defence, or our daily tasks, we should remember it is part of the one life. In times of universal stress, such as the present, we find ourselves sensitised to things of which we're normally unaware, or of which, though we may know in theory, we may have had no personal experience. Among these is the group soul of the race. Who has not felt a sense of participation in this larger being, a total inability to insulate ourselves from it, however we might try? We realize with inescapable clearness that we are parts of a larger whole and that none can live unto himself. We learn from actual experience the meaning of the words, we are all members one of another. But in addition to the group soul, there is also the group mind, and we must distinguish between them in theory, though in practice they are inseparable. The group soul is to a race what the subconscious mind is to an individual. It contains the cumulative experience of the past. It acts as a counterpoise against all shifts of the winds of changing circumstance. So instead of being blown hither and thither, the trend of the crowd mind will be steadfast and predictable. But the group soul of a nation is much more than a sense of stability. It is a source of inexhaustible dynamic energy, and we as individuals draw on it. We do this unconsciously in any case, but we can also do it consciously and deliberately and for specific purposes. The group mind, on the other hand, is comparatively superficial, shifting and veering with the surface currents and the winds of circumstance. It can be compared to the surface of consciousness of an individual. But though it is superficial in itself, it rests on the solid foundation of the group soul. Nevertheless, being unstable, easily influenced, it can be swayed by propaganda, by rumour, by personal feelings and the interests of individuals and groups. And it can, as it were, become detached from its solid base over considerable areas, rising up like bubbles on the surface of a boiling liquid. It is for us to understand the nature of the invisible realities and have trained ourselves in their use to bring all our force to bear and to hold the race life to give firmly together as an unified whole, welded to a spiritual basis like a house built upon a rock that cannot be moved. Now, what her idea, her thesis is around this whole work that she does in this time is that she isn't sort of influencing, sending energy out with her mind to influence Hitler, to confuse Nazis or to encourage Churchill. She's talking about that in a way the same process that we do when we go into meditation and come down into ourselves. So she's talking about doing that on a collective basis. What she's saying is, in this vision of the interwoven world, that we are, our individual nature is deeply interwoven with the collective consciousness of the country, of the nation. And that the work that she and her fraternity are about to do is to work with those deep layers and to enable integration between the surface levels of that kind of group consciousness and the deep levels. That's really the kind of function, and it comes from a place of while there is clarity and she does various things, it's not even about making the Germans into the enemy. Which, given that war has just been declared, it's 1939, is quite an interesting approach in some ways. So this is not riding to war to kill the Nazis. This is actually bringing, the intention here is to bring life and energy into the kind of collective aspect of the dynamics of the nation. And she goes on to say in the following week, which is in 15th of October 1939, upon which time we discover the compulsory national service has been introduced in Finland, which I didn't know personally, but that's good to know. She begins though by saying that we've made a start on the work that we have set out to do, the opening of a channel whereby spiritual influences can contact the group mind of the race. So she sees herself really and sees the group as opening this channel, which because of the interconnection of things, they can seed ideas, energies, influences that influence the whole. So again, this is the small influencing the big. This is again this kind of idea of the chaos theory idea of actually something little, apparently little, can come in that can work from underneath to influence things. And she goes on to say that some 8 weeks ago we decided to call together a group of our friends and members to form the nucleus of a meditation circle, and the date we got everybody together, the first date we got together was Sunday, October the 1st, so that's 2 weeks previous to this letter. This date was chosen for psychic reasons as being the one in which the forces with which you proposed to cooperate would commence to flow. It's interesting that the same day was subsequently selected by the religious denominations of this country as a day of prayer, a day of national day of prayer and intercession. And she's interested in that as an example of synchronicity, because she has first felt that this day was important as a day when this spiritual support was needed for the country. And independently, the day gets chosen as a day of national prayer. So it's just, again, interesting synchronicity. At the meeting held at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, October the 1st, the address and meditation instruction were based on the opening and communications of the series, which were already stenciled and ready, and because they were doing it in a stencil and all this, and ready to be sent out on the appointed day. Members and friends assembled there meditated with the view of getting in touch with the group mind of the race, in order these teachings should be given to it through the invisible psychic channels that from time immemorial initiates have made use of in order to help the group mind of the nation they serve. Those who were assembled at that first meeting can bear witness to the fact they were told the ideas that were being held for the group meditations would inoculate the group mind of the race, and would shortly be expressed in influential quarters that would ensure them a hearing. And this was the way the adepts whose group mind forms the higher self of the race has always worked. So what they're being told there, what she's telling them, is that the ideas that they're doing, that they're just bringing through, they can expect to discover are synchronously emerging in other parts of the nation. So she's saying to them, you're dealing with this collective kind of field. Now you think that what you're doing is just kind of individual, and we're just a group of people sitting in a room together, but we're bringing these ideas through our bodies, through our imaginations, into the collective life of the nation. And therefore, if you pay attention, you will notice those similar ideas arising in other places. It's a bit like they've gone into the root life of the nation and come up through the stem and appear on as different flowers at some other point. So again, she's calling on the idea of synchronicity, and you know, notice the link between the inside and the outside. And in a way, we're not doing it in her way, but that's why I bang on so much about synchronicity. There's something about synchronicity as the kind of the link between the inside and the outside that really helps to dismantle or to soften anyway this kind of feeling that the inside and the outside are completely separate. She goes on to say, 36 hours later, at 8 p.m. on Monday evening, the address and meditation given on that occasion were repeated almost verbatim by the Archbishop of York broadcasting to the nation. Is this again a coincidence, or is it a further confirmation of the existence of spiritual influences at work on the inner planes? I draw attention to these things not because I wish to boast, because I like that nothing more than that, but because of the confirmation they give us of the occult teaching considering the invisible governance of the world. So she's saying the reason to look at this is actually it gives us some confidence or some connection to the idea that things are deeply kind of interconnected. The meditation work that was given upon at the end of this letter was making contact with the spiritual influences ruling our race, using for this purpose the symbol of the rose upon the cross. So, what there's a whole. I'm not going to go through every letter because we'll be here for days. But what starts to happen? That's the kind of basic kind of background. This and the basic kind of methodology that she uses, And so she takes this idea of making contact with the deeper spiritual ground that can inform not just the individuals but the collective experience. And she uses the image, this image of the rose the rose upon the cross. It's a sort of Rosicrucian. I mean, Rosicrucians were 16th century kind of group that looked at the sort of a mystical Christianity, and it's the particular tradition that she draws from, that she was trained in, her connection with these people called the Rosicrucians. Now, the Rose Cross itself is the image of a Christian cross with a rose at its center. And it's an idea that it's a kind of quite a powerful meditation image. And again, it's an image that its simplest form really is a cross with a circle around it. And in this more kind of elaborate image, it becomes a sort of wooden cross with a blooming rose. And for a Christian mystic at that time, the cross represents inevitably the death of Christ, but the rose represents resurrection. So the image that's chosen is an image of death and resurrection, and has the intention of linking with something that can support the life of the nation. Now, what happens is, as this kind of process kind of continues, and they do this week by week, meditating on ideas, and there's a whole kind of, and in the various letters, she points attention to synchronicities that kind of emerge. So she's helping people to understand. And the synchronicities she points to are quite precise. She's not a flake. You know, this is a very kind of grounded, kind of no-nonsense kind of woman in some ways. So when she's pointing towards things, she's pointing to things that have happened in meditation that there is a precise analog with. And this is always a key thing with synchronicity. The synchronicity that works is precise, and it takes us aback. It stops us in our tracks. And it stops us in our tracks because that moment of noticing the coming together of the inside and the outside challenges that place where we think it's really separate. If we feel comfortable about a synchronicity, it's likely fantasy. Like, I think that there's always something quite shocking about synchronicity. It's just sort of because it breaks a bubble. The bubble where we think we're completely set inside is completely separate from outside. And so there's, through that book, there's a whole lot of synchronicities. But the meditation itself kind of develops, in a sense. It's because it starts off with people just contemplating this image of the Rose Cross and contemplating this idea of bringing spiritual support to the deeper life of the collective, of the nation. It becomes, the Rose Cross becomes a more formed image, an actual cross with 22 petals on it. That the cross at one point becomes golden, and the rose itself becomes outlined in a kind of diamond white light. All of which has meaning to her, but it appears in a cave at the foot of inside Glastonbury Tor. So the meditation begins by being very abstract and has an abstract quality in it, but also starts to become embodied in an actual space, and an actual place, because the Glastonbury Tor is seen as somewhere that she sees as an important spiritual place in the heart of Britain, and what happens is people are then invited to meditate as if they are within Glastonbury Tor. Now, there's no actual cave within Glastonbury Tor. You know, it's full of water, for one thing, and so there are spaces in it, but it's full of water. So if you actually literally put yourself in there, you just drown. But what you're getting is a sense of embodiment, a sense of localization in space, and a sense of going into the deep earth. So there's something about this idea of embodying an image that represents kind of death and resurrection, being literally going, and this sense of going into the collective, into the group soul, coming literally into the ground in the middle of the country, going down into the earth at a place that has been connected with the spiritual life of the nation for many centuries. Glastonbury having been one of the really important abbey towns of the country. And in the unfortunate understanding, a place where the ancient pagan traditions come together with Christian tradition. So it's a spiritual place that brings opposites together. So the fact that the meditation starts to focus on Glastonbury, starts to become more embodied here. It contains within it this idea of bringing opposites together, and is connected, and somewhere the idea of it being connected to the spiritual life of the country. What then starts to happen is a sort of, so again, this is little by little, week by week, is it an image of the tree of life starts to form within the cavern. And she experiences sort of a triangle of three colours forming, a purple triangle, a blue ray and a red ray. Now these, I'll just show you this on the Tree of Life. Now, the cavern is at the root of the Tree of Life. So here's the cavern in the earth, Malkuth. Purple is one of the colours given to Yesod, which is the foundation of the soul of the world. The blue and the red are much deeper in the tree, so it's a connection. So the red would be here, blue would be here. This is Geburah and Hesed. So Geburah, the Hesed, place of love and compassion, blue. Purple is the foundation of life, foundation of the soul. Here, the place of will, there, the place of compassion. So what is being connected, what she starts to see here is a connection between the deeper parts of the Tree of Life and the outer parts that come through the group out into the outside world. So what you saw, and connected, and eventually what you get the form of Arthur, archetypal form of Arthur here, Merlin here, and the image of Christ here in Yesod.
Can you say it again?
Yeah. Sorry. So what you have here, you have the cavern down the bottom in the place of earth, and you then have these three, so this great triangle being formed, which connects. There, the sphere at the bottom is Yesod, the foundation of life, and she's experienced this as a sort of purple kind of ray. And she sees it, and it's connected with the image of Christ holding a chalice. So the image of the chalice comes in here. You get the figure of Arthur in the red sphere, where holding the sword of will.
That's the
top left-hand side. This is the sphere of Geburah. And then opposite that, you have the blue sphere of Hesed, the sphere of love, where you have Merlin holding a scepter.
That's Yesod, isn't it?
No, Merlin is in Hesed. Yesod is here. Yesod is the foundation sphere. So the names don't matter so much. The images are more important, actually. Because the images that emerge in terms of what we've been doing this weekend are kind of quite important, because you have the image of the cup, the image of the sword, and then you have the image of this diamond scepter, which is the sort of mediating kind of principle that runs from the height to the depth, and that represents the ability of awareness to focus. And what is focused are these two images, the image of the chalice, which is the image of containment, and the image of the will that focuses the energy.
The will is the sword,
is in Arthur, it's a sword. Like Arthur is holding the sword. So Arthur is imagined as a king at war, right? So this image of sovereignty comes in, yes, because you've got these two kingly images. So Arthur is seen as a warrior on a horse with his sword. Merlin is seen as a seated king holding a diamond scepter.
That's Merlin on the right.
Merlin is on the right then. Okay.
What's a diamond scepter?
It's like a rod made of diamond, right? And it kind of represents, like a diamond, it represents the focused and trained will, in a way, focused and trained mind, because a diamond focuses energy. Another thing happens, this flips, this sort of two-dimensional image flips into a three-dimensional image, so it inverts itself. So you're not going to be worried about the tree of life, right now, not even too worried about the detail. But what happens is that Christ suddenly, the Christ figure suddenly flips up and becomes the root of the other rays, and the Virgin Mary turns up holding the chalice. Because actually the thing's an embalanced image at first, it's just all these blokes here. Christ, in a certain sense, is androgynous, in her way of understanding it. You then have the image of a goddess figure holding a chalice. You have the sword of will, and then you have this mediating principle of the scepter.
Now, I'll keep you back in there. Does Christ give the chalice to the woman?
It just flips. It doesn't. No, it flips. So as can happen in meditation, you work with a form, and it suddenly just flips over. So suddenly she says, "Oh, this becomes three-dimensional." You know. So suddenly it's not. It's like it enters another dimension. Christ vanishes out of there, and Virgin Mary turns up there holding the cup, and Christ is seen as this ovoid of light, egg of light, that manifests the other ray, the other energies. The detail doesn't matter, because it's more the process, right? So we don't have to understand what she was doing, because we'll never have to do that. But what's interesting is the energies that she ends up working with are the energies that we've been looking at this weekend. In our symbolism that we've been looking at, they're the sword, the cup, and they are the white heart. The diamond scepter is the white heart. It's the mediating principle. It's the middle pillar. It's the shin coming down into expression. Yes, it is that. The sword is the sword of will. The cup is the holding kind of principle. Now, so what she does, and there's a whole kind of set. So this then becomes the sort of framework that she is working with, and each of these things appear, and they are through their meditations. They're sort of, if you like, sent out into these images, these ideas are embodied in the collective life through her mediation, really, and through the mediation of anybody meditating upon it. And I'll just give an example of something that she shows. What?
Can I just check? Sorry to interrupt you. But
go on.
Different colours.
Purple
at the bottom, red and blue.
Yeah.
Where's the red and where's the blue?
Sorry, red is there, blue is over there.
Thank
okay.
You.
Right at the bottom has it, well, that's you standing in the cavern, right? That's Earth, right? So that's the place. So that's where you're standing on Earth. So basically, in the meditation, as you enter that meditation, you enter the place of Earth, the bottom tree of the tree of life, and you've got this in the background. You've got this image of the rose cross, and then this sort of triangle of energy starts to form around you, and in front of you, I guess, really, and then these. Like as what happens is when you meditate upon things, these forms appear and then they sort of shift. So initially these are just colours, right? These are just colours that appear. There's a purple colour, there's a red colour, there's a blue colour. As you stay with that, they become a bit more distinct, more formed to you. So what happens is the image of Christ holding a cup appears within the purple. The image of Arthur appears within the red colour. The image of Merlin appears within the blue colour. As you stay with that, then these deeper images emerge of the kind of the diamond sceptre, of the sword, and of the cup. Right? So you don't, and if you try and understand it too much, you lose the point of it, because actually what's happening is something deeper is emerging each time that's more, so first of all it's a colour and you get a feeling, but it becomes more embodied and more precise. So you come then to the idea of the sword and the chalice and this diamond sceptre that sort of mediates between the energies of the sword and the chalice. And just before we finish, I'll just give you an example of some of the ways she talks about how to use this. Right. So what she does, this is an example of her working with the energy of the sword, really. The outline of the astral images were peculiarly steady and solid. And the power came down in symbolic form of a great jet of steel grey water from the ray of Geburah, from the ray of the sword. There was a tremendous sense of strength under control, of steadiness, of a complete grip on the forces that were being brought through. There was a profound sense of peace and protection that was remarked on by all present. We must hold firmly before the soul of the race a bracing, astringent ideal, not relaxing our watch or laying down our weapons till the word is given. Premature and unsound peace will be disastrous. Our increasing confidence lays us open to subtle influence against which we must guard. In order to guard against any such subtle influence, we will meditate upon angelic presences, red-robed and armed, patrolling the length and breadth of our land. Visualize a map of Great Britain and picture those great presences moving as a shadowy form, a vast shadowy form along the coast and backwards and forwards from north to south and east to west, keeping watch and ward so that nothing alien can move unobserved. So that's where that kind of inner work comes outwards into this sense of, so this is the energy of the sword being applied to kind of protect and create boundary and edge. In this case, around the country, because she's looking at the whole country. And then she goes on to say, the work of the formulation of the angelic presences is so valuable that it should be continued for the duration. So that's an example of the sword. Yeah, I'm just looking for the diamond zipped. Just secure. Yeah. Okay, she goes on to talk about the diamond scepter. The rod of power or diamond scepter is a concept well known to those who study the secret tradition. No doubt in the past it is given symbolic form as a rod, possibly jewelled, but actually it is the trained mind of the initiate. In earlier letters we considered the ways in which ideals could be instilled telepathically into the group mind of a race by someone who was a member of that race and therefore had access to its group mind, living them out in practice with intention. It will be noticed, however, that we've defined the rod of power as the trained mind of an initiate, not merely as the trained mind. An initiate, by virtue of knowledge and training, is in touch with cosmic forces and makes themselves a channel for their manifestation, their mind selecting and directing them. This is the real diamond scepter. For this use of this method, a group of trained and dedicated people is needed. The training is in the traditional method of the mysteries, whereby control not only of the mind, but also of the magnetic energies of the etheric double is obtained. The dedication is first to the One, the Unity, the Godhead, and secondly to one or another of the great mystical orders. In our own case, the order is indicated by the symbol we use to open our meditation, that's the Rose Cross. All who care to take the work seriously can be of help in this task and participate in experience. They can all form facets of the diamond scepter, helping with the transmission of the spiritual influences thus invoked. Once the link is made, the power is soon flowing spontaneously. Knowledge is needed to pick up the force and direct it, and this knowledge is supplied by the leader of the group. But none who are sincerely dedicated to the love and service of man and God need feel that they are without value in the work. Naturally, the more knowledge and trained mind power there is, the better. But devotion and deep spiritual feeling contemplate the work, something for which knowledge alone is no substitute. And she goes on to say, really, that when we meditated on the diamond scepter, certain points, certain things became clear. It's obvious that we're dealing with Arthurian symbolism in the cup and the sword, and this would fit in well with the nature of our glyph if we take the king to be armed king to be King Arthur and the throne king as Merlin.
Armed king is Arthur.
Is Arthur, so he's the king he's the guy with the sword, right? And throne king is Merlin. So what she's doing there is taking this, is working with the images of Arthur and Merlin, and because this is a story that comes out of the collective stories of Britain. So she's using that idea, but she's interpreting it in a way that the if you like the kind of the sword represent the sword scepter represents that energy of the scepter represents that energy of the trained mind of the initiate, which is the core of the work that's being done. So that as you hold the scepter, or imagine yourself holding the scepter, you're bringing that energy. It's like the white heart. You're bringing that energy from the inner into active outer expression through your body. You're bringing it down into the earth. So in a sense, you're the cup in a way is that a sense of compassion and love that enables us to hold ourselves and others. The energy of will is that energy of protection and challenge and boundary. And the scepter is that sense of centering yourself and letting the ideas come down through you into the deep, into the earth, into the life of the race. Now, we need to finish now, but we'll come back. Yeah, you could do it. That's right. Yeah,
what
King. Well, there's a whole lot of ideas. The main ideas, the ideas that you're mainly channeling are ideas that connect the life of the race to being part of the interwoven world. And the ideas that are channeled in through this whole work she does are twofold. They're ideas of protection because you're at war. Mm-hmm. And the other ideas are ones of not hating, but bringing a sort of spiritual vitality into people's lives, so the larger context is not taken away. So you do not lose yourself in hatred, mm-hmm. so that you feel protected, but are not lost in hatred. Mm-hmm. Right. So this idea where they're holding the life of the nation steady, mm-hmm. so they're being in one sense practical and boundaried and creating boundary, and at another level linking to the deeper life of the world. So that's, we'll come back to this. I'm going to explore this whole piece of work. So she did, particularly she did it here. And we're also going to maybe do some work connected with it and which will involve, if the weather's right, hopefully actually going up to the Tor and sitting in meditation in the Tor and tuning into whatever we find of that. But the thing that's really kind of interesting is that in 1942, she decides, right, that's it, the war is now won. On inner levels, the war is won. You know, a seership says to her, right, that's great, we don't have to worry about that now. We now have to focus, and this is 1942, this is well before D-Day, and this is well before the Battle of Britain even. You know, the things are not actually brilliant, but her inner perception at this point is that Britain has now won the war. And now we have to, our energy has to focus on reconstructing and creating peace. And I'll come back to this, don't be worried about it, I'll come back to this in more detail when we next meet up, really. But I just wanted to give you a bit of a flavour of it as we end today.
Did you tape that?
All that's taped, yeah. yeah, it's all taped. And don't worry about it, we'll come back to it. If you're interested in